past week of the perils of trying to fit big ideas into small spaces. If you were here, you might recall that we spent the talky bit exploring some ideas about the science of genetics and its impact on our concepts of God. Well, those are both categorically big ideas, and 30 minutes of reflection on them is bound to leave out more than it includes. So, despite my stated disdain, which is always a hazardous thing to do, for what I've called bumper sticker ideas, when I try to open up something as big as that, I sometimes feel like I'm more part of the problem than part of the solution. I don't feel ashamed or guilty about it. I just feel more frustrated by the limitations it reveals in my own thinking, in my own communicating, and also just in the setting and the time available for those kinds of explorations. But when I stand back from all of that a bit, I tend to come back to reminding myself that what we're on about here together is a multi-part endeavor. Exploring what we believe might happen in a partial way when we gather, but I think this time together really functions best as a catalyst, as a kind of way of stirring the pot of our thinking and believing and helping us to pay attention to what's going on around us, within us, and between us, both in this community and in the wider world. I expect that some of those frustrations I just mentioned will be part of today's experience as well, because the general topic that I'm going to engage with here feels pretty sprawling. So last week we launched the talky bit with a moment from our own in-house Dylan cover band, and Dylan's reminders that the times they are changing, and the metaphor of rising waters that challenge us to either start swimming or get ready to drown. In his words, you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. So I'm going to set up this week's explorations with the words from verse 2, and I would say I'm thinking of myself as the first object of the critique that they offer. So Dylan writes in that verse, "Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes open. Don't speak too soon, for the chance won't come again, and the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing." So that, keep your eyes open, don't speak too soon, the wheel's still in spin, that feels like a pretty applicable cautionary posture from which to consider the future. And this morning we're going to be in, I would say, quite speculative terrain regarding what might be coming in the days ahead. So with that note of don't speak too soon as the undertone for all of this, I'm just going to press on. I think it's a good idea to at least occasionally read or listen to people you really don't resonate with, or who may even you may even profoundly disagree with. One of my primary sources this morning is an author that has met with noteworthy contemporary success and who I think has rattled the cage of some important ideas, but whose way of doing that and whose core assumptions are not ones I'm uniformly drawn to at all. This author is a blogger named Mark Manson, who came into view most prominently in 2016 with his best-selling book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Just a side note, I'm going to stick with Manson's publisher's choice about his frequent use of the F-bomb and just use a designate for it, usually F. I'm going to do that in the interest, among other things, of not having people who might be listening to this as a podcast in the car having to unpack that word for the kids in the back seat on the way to school, who might otherwise just generally find it offensive. Personally, although I feel like I get his point in making this word choice, I pretty quickly got tired of its broness and its ubiquity, and it felt like the very point he was trying to make got lost in the blizzard of its frequency. Apparently, Mr. Manson either wasn't aware of or just flat out chose to ignore the research that says that using a word the culture regards as profane or marginal loses its impact with frequency. So if you want to get someone's attention at work and you never swear at work, then swear and they'll pay attention. If you swear at work all the time, that's just how they talk, and it loses its oomph. And it feels like that's sort of what happens here. But in any case, The Subtle Art of, and so on, takes on what Manson views as the mindless positivity of most self-help books, and the argument they make is that those books are neither practical nor helpful, and that it's life's struggles that give it meaning. So again, not an idea that struggles to give it meaning, not an idea that's original to Manson, but one that they've kind of put into popular parlance in a way that sold a lot of books. And in those sorts of very general terms, I might tend to say, so far, so good. If we can't find a way of approaching suffering that includes some way to sort of make meaning of it or regard its meaning, I think we're probably destined to discover that our worldview is going to be inadequate to our experiences because we're going to suffer. Now, Manson's follow-up book is entitled Everything is Effed, a book about hope, and it continues that theme, but it takes it a bit farther into the philosophical underpinnings of it. All right, so very short version, which, as I said at the outset, will leave a lot of nuance by the wayside. Manson's thinking stands on the long-established work of Nietzsche and Kant. Now, those two philosophers didn't exactly see eye to eye on some rather large themes. That's a confusion that Manson leaves unaddressed. I think he just sort of, cherry-picks those two philosophers. But where he ends up in that process, again, in very general terms, is Stoicism as a system of thought. We've touched on this here before, but Stoicism is a 3rd century BCE Greek philosophy that taught that virtue based on knowledge is the highest good, so the best thing there is virtue based on knowledge, and that if we're wise, we will live in harmony with reason. And in this school of thought, reason is the divine, so reason is a proper noun. Also sometimes referred to, again, as proper noun, as fate or providence. So virtue based on knowledge is the highest good, and if you're wise, you live in harmony with reason or fate or providence. Reason governs nature in this school of thought, and if we're wise, we will learn, as nature shows us, how to be indifferent to the ups and downs of fortune and pleasure and pain. And so that's the lesson to be learned from pain, is that it shouldn't govern us. In any case, we're going to leave that for another day, but there's actually quite a significant overlap in many of the ideas of Stoicism and the ideas of Christianity, as well as some significant differences. They are not, as many people suppose, polar opposites. And so that might just be important I don't think we should be dismissive of this whole thought system just because perhaps our prevailing system of thought or worldview is recognizable as Christian in some way. In any case, Manson in this book is addressing himself to a very old human question, which is, how should we live? And he answers it in no small part by saying that we need to stop joining hope clubs and get on with learning from our suffering. Hope clubs, let me define that a little bit more from his perspective. Hope clubs fall into, for Manson, 3 categories. Spiritualities in general, so all of them. Ideological hope clubs, which he identifies as the isms, things like communism, capitalism, anarchism, fascism, environmentalism, feminism, leftism, and so on. And interpersonal hope clubs, which he basically calls people worship, things like romance or celebrity or children and so on. He is, as you may be able to imagine by now, if you haven't read him, just based on this summary, he is utterly dismissive of religion in general as a path that might contribute to hope, because he believes that to join any such hope club means we have had to check our critical thinking at the door. Now, more than a couple of us have encountered that reality in our own religious experience, that we're not only expected to not be critical, but that to do so is to reveal our inherent brokenness, our sinful nature, in some especially egregious way. To be critical is to be disobedient, to be part of the problem, not part of the way forward. So it's not like Manson is making this idea up. It's a real part of real people's experiences. And I'm intrigued that given this backdrop, Manson devotes an entire chapter late in the book to what he calls the final religion. Like there's a deity in everything. And he sets it up by telling the story about Google's AI program, AlphaZero. When I encountered this story, I thought, AlphaZero? Maybe that's a coincidental name, but given the way the book of Revelation describes God as the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, it felt a bit to me like saying, like Google saying, the beginning of everything is a zero. It's a computer code, and we've got it. I have no idea, of course, if that's what the folks at Google had in mind, but if they didn't have it in mind, I think they, stumbled onto an intriguing name. In any case, AlphaZero is AI software that is designed to learn, and the public proving ground for it was initially computerized chess. Now, Chess is a pretty great way to test smart computers because it contains almost infinite variations. Like, as a game, the possibilities are almost infinite. In fact, there are, mathematically speaking, more possible chess games than there are atoms in the observable universe. No wonder I'm so terrible at this game. And if you look only four moves ahead in any game of chess, there are already hundreds of millions of possible variations. So that's kind of staggering. And it's been decades now since computer programs started beating the best human chess players regularly, sometimes pretty much crushing them in the process. And along the way, chess software has improved exponentially. As it got more popular, there's more resources in it, more development happened, more information went into the programs, and they just kept getting better. The top dog for quite some time has been a program called Stockfish. Now, Stockfish is a chess-playing program. That's what it does. And it can look at any possible chess setup and calculate 70 million possible board positions per second. So, our human brains can't even begin to approach that. And over the last couple of decades or so, the Stockfish software has just kept getting better and better, until basically it's become, in industry terms, the standard that all chess software was measured against, until Google came along in 2018 with AlphaZero. Now, AlphaZero is not chess software. Unlike Stockfish, it's AI software that's designed to learn new things, especially new games. It had no previous chess programming in it when the Google engineers gave it 24 hours to learn the game. So it spent most of that time running chess games against itself, learning from its mistakes as it went along. And by the end of that time, it could calculate only 80,000 board positions per second compared to Stockfish's 70 million board positions per second. But when the two computers went head-to-head, so to speak, in a 100-game series of chess games, AlphaZero won or drew every single game. Okay, I'm going to stop nerding out now and talk about the religion part. So for Manning, where this story is headed is toward a future in which AI learns to learn so well and so fast that, quote, it will reach a point where its intelligence outstrips ours by so much that we will no longer comprehend what it's doing, close quote. In Manning's imagined future, quote, cars will pick us up for reasons we don't understand and take us to locations we didn't know existed. We will unexpectedly receive medications for health issues we didn't know we suffered from. It's possible that our kids will switch schools. We will change jobs. Economic policies will abruptly shift. Governments will rewrite their constitutions. And none of us will comprehend the full reasons why. It will just happen. Our thinking brains will be too slow. Well, this thinking brain, feeling brain thing is also a very important part of Madsen's idea set in the book. Our thinking brains will be too slow and our feeling brains too erratic and dangerous. Like AlphaZero inventing chess strategies in mere hours that chess's greatest minds could not anticipate, advanced AI could reorganize society and all our places within it in ways we can't imagine, close quote. So, is that the description of an AI apocalypse or an AI paradise or heaven? Is this, I don't understand it, so it must be a God thing. Ever heard that phrase used to describe something that someone didn't understand how it happened? Well, Tim, that's kind of a religious question, and I thought we were talking about computers. Well, that's exactly where Manning takes it. His premise, and this is interesting, I think, and this is what drew me to this whole portion of his book, his premise is that we deify what we can't understand. We deify what we can't understand. And in this story about the future that he's telling, the thing that we don't understand is AI, artificial intelligence. In his words, we, quote, will end up right back where we began, worshiping impossible and unknowable forces that seemingly control our fates, close quote. worshiping impossible and unknowable forces that seemingly control our fates. Does that sound like any description of the divine that you've ever heard? Any way of talking about God? He goes on to say this. The old gods will be replaced by the new gods, the algorithms. And in a twist of evolutionary irony, the same science that killed the gods of old will have built the gods of new. There will be a great return to religiosity among humankind. Oh, actually, he writes mankind there. Sorry, I'm just adjusting. And our religions won't necessarily be so different from the religions of the ancient world. After all, our psychology has fundamentally evolved to deify what it doesn't understand, to exalt the forces that help or harm us, to construct systems of values around our experiences, to seek out conflict that generates hope. Now, for me, there are several places in that paragraph where Manning and I part ways, including him touching on his belief that war is good because it brings out the best in us. Nietzsche, of course, was a big fan of violence too in a similar way, so maybe that's not a surprise. Thought Hitler was pretty great. But that idea that as humans we deify what we don't understand, that's an intriguing one to me. His idea that we should pay more attention to what we're evolving toward than what we've evolved from, that's an interesting idea. His idea that it's our making assumptions about what we know and making them with what he calls blind, fervent, emotional certainty that gets us into the most trouble to begin with, that idea suggests further exploration might be in order. Now, I mean, again, as I've said several times already, we're just leaving a lot of things by the wayside with an exploration like this. So I acknowledge that, and my intent is to stir our thinking pots rather than watch them settle into sediment. I heard a very well-educated and highly regarded preacher a couple of weeks ago talking about climate change. And they were careful to reference their sources, and they did a beautiful job of speaking about a complex issue. In the end, however, they were of the opinion that if Christianity doesn't point people to a life beyond this one, it has nothing truly meaningful to say to this issue or the deep anxiety it provokes in many people. And I say, however, about that, because that idea feels like it's central to why so many people are abandoning the Christian religion, because in many forms, it is predicated on a predetermined future, already set in place by a deity whose actions we can't begin to understand. And that makes Christianity unable to be lively in its response to the present and the near future, including possible futures like the one Manson is describing. And so we end up with a bunch of people for whom their religion is in a box, maybe even in a building or a location, but it doesn't really seem to have anything to say about ideas like the one that Manson is talking about here. So we're asking the question, is our God concept ready for the future? Well, which future? Do I mean one in which we end up worshiping an algorithm? Do I mean one in which God snatches us all out of here before God's position in the universe is threatened by a deity that's made up of ones and zeros? Or maybe we're talking about the one in which the power goes out, and it turns out we should have all been practicing how to hunt, fish, and garden instead of posting on Instagram that the preppers were right, and one in which primitive religion starts to look like it had the right ideas all along, and I use the word primitive there advisedly. Or how about the future that we can't see coming at all? Well, taking Dylan to heart, I'm not going to say too much while the wheel is still spinning, and it's always spinning. We are, of course, not the first community to explore this, so I want to leave us with another God concept to consider rather than saying, here's who the winners and losers will be in all of this, and suggesting that a certain belief system is going to keep us safe from the possible negative implications of such a future vision, or just yank us out of here if things get too ugly. Last week I introduced the term panentheism as a way of imagining a picture of God as a spirit that interpenetrates the universe rather than as a superperson that sometimes intervenes in our lives. I'm going to add an idea to that. This is an idea that has developed within evangelical and post-evangelical Christianity, which I realize, you know, may or may not commend it to you. But either way, its roots are visible, and it's connected at the hip to panentheism, which is why I wanted to mention it. In theological terms, it's called openness theology or open theism. And again, simply stated, this is an idea about God in the future that suggests that since God is free and humans are free, God's knowledge is dynamic, that is, it changes, and God's providence or actions, their will, what they do, those actions are flexible. And so we end up with the picture of the future in terms of its relationship to the divine, in which the future isn't locked into a single fixed trajectory. It's more like a plurality of branching possibilities, with some of those possibilities becoming settled as time moves forward. Becoming settled as time moves forward feels like an interesting part of this to me, feels like there's a lot there to explore that we're not going to take the time for at the moment, for sure. In any case, this is the sort of God concept that uniquely makes room for convictions like God is love, which we've talked about here before and which we'll explore a bit more next week. And it also makes a wider space in which to seek to be better humans now without laboring under the idea that that's a bit of a useless endeavor because all of the outcomes are foreordained and locked in by God. And maybe it's a sort of God concept that also makes room for us to both love God and not fear the future. Well, honestly, I don't know how to end this one. So how about this? Over to you. I'm going to go home and see how I can do with loving the people I'm with. And maybe I'll try to be uniquely kind to my smartphone so that if it turns out to be God, I'll kind of have, you know, like a little relational head start in convincing it to go easy on me. All right. Peace, everybody.